Over time, we knew, our urge to unify and share would expand until we sensed a special community, a deeper association with others who shared a particular geographical location on the planet. And the human world would begin to solidify into political nation-states, each holding a unique viewpoint. Soon after would come an explosion of trade and commerce. The scientific method would be instituted, and the resulting discoveries would initiate a period of economic preoccupation and the great secular expansion known as the Industrial Revolution. And once we developed a web of economic relationships around the globe, we would begin to further awaken and to remember our full spiritual nature. The insights would gradually permeate human consciousness, and we would evolve our economy into a form compatible with the earth, and finally begin to move beyond the last fearful polarization of forces toward a new spiritual worldview on the planet. Suddenly, the hologram focused on the polarization in great detail. All humans on the earth were quickly migrating into two conflicting positions, one pushing toward a vague but ever clearer image of transformation, and the other resisting, sensing that important values contained in the old view were being lost forever. We could see that in the afterlife dimension, it was known that this conflict would be our greatest challenge to the spiritualization of the physical dimension, particularly if the polarization grew extreme. In this case, both sides would entrench into an irrational projection of evil onto the other, or worse, might believe the literal interpreters of the end times prophecies and begin to think the future was beyond their influence, and therefore give up completely. To find the world vision and resolve the polarization, we could see that our afterlife intention was to discern the deeper truths of these prophecies. As with all the scriptures, the visions in Daniel and Revelations were divine intuitions coming from the afterlife into the physical plane, and so must be understood as draped in the symbolism of the seer's mind, much like a dream. The prophecies envisioned an eventual end to the human story on earth, but an end that, for believers, would be quite different from the one experienced by non-believers. Those in the latter group were seen to experience an end of history that would begin with great catastrophes and environmental disasters, collapsing economies. Then, at the height of the fear and chaos, a strong leader would emerge, the Antichrist, who would offer to restore order, but only if individuals would agree to give up their liberties and carry the mark of the beast upon their bodies in order to participate in the automated economy. Eventually, this strong leader would declare himself a god and take by force any country that resisted his rule, at first making war on the forces of Islam, then on the Jews and Christians, ultimately casting the whole world into a fiery Armageddon. For believers, on the other hand, the scriptural prophets predicted a much more pleasant end to history. Remaining true to the spirit, these believers would be given spiritual bodies and be raptured into another dimension called the New Jerusalem, but would be able to go back and forth into the physical. Eventually, at a certain point in the war, God would fully return to end the fighting, restore the earth, and implement 1,000 years of peace where there would be no sickness or death, and everything would be transformed, even the animals of the world, who would no longer eat meat. Instead, the lion would lay down with the lamb. Maya and Curtis caught my eye, and then Charlene looked up. We all seemed to sense at once the core meaning of the prophecies. What the end time seers were receiving was an intuition that in our time, two distinctive futures would be opening before us. We could choose either to languish in the fear, believing that the world is moving into a Big Brother-style automation and social decay and ultimate destruction, or we could follow the other path and consider ourselves the believers who can overcome this nihilism and open to the higher vibrations of love, where we are spared the apocalypse and can enter a new dimension in which we invite the Spirit, through us, to create just the utopia the scriptural prophets envisioned. Now we could see why those in the afterlife felt that our interpretation of these prophecies was key to resolving the polarization. If we decide that these scriptures mean that the destruction of the world is inevitable, written unalterably into God's plan, the effect of such a belief would be to create this very outcome. Suddenly, the hologram raced forward, and I felt another expansion of consciousness. I knew that we were now moving into the next step of the process, the actual remembrance of how we intended to become believers and accomplish this prophesied utopian future. We were finally remembering the world vision. As we watched, we first saw 10th Insight groups forming all over the planet, pulling in the world vision, reaching critical mass, and then learning to project this vision in such a way that the entrenched sides of the polarization immediately began to lighten and ease, letting go of the fear. Especially affected would be the technological controllers, who would remember themselves and give up their last efforts to manipulate the economy and seize power. The result of the projected vision would be an unprecedented wave of awakening and remembrance and cooperation and personal involvement, and a virtual explosion of newly inspired individuals, each of whom would begin to fully recall their birth visions and follow their synchronistic path into exactly the right occupational position within their culture. The scene shifted to images of decaying inner cities and forgotten rural families. Here we could see a new consensus forming on how to intervene in the cycle of poverty. No longer would intervention be conceived in terms of government programs or merely in terms of education and jobs. The new approach would be deeply spiritual, for the structures of education were already in place. What was missing was the ability to break free from the fear and to overcome the hellish diversion set up to ward off the anxiety of poverty. As this contagion continued, incidents of violent crime began to mysteriously decrease across human culture. For, as we saw clearly, the roots of violence are always frustration and passion and fear that dehumanize the victim, and a growing interaction with those carrying a higher awareness was now beginning to disrupt this mindset. Simultaneously, as increasingly more people awakened, I saw millions of individuals taking time to intervene in conflict at every level of human culture. For we all were reaching a new understanding of what was at stake. In every situation where a husband or wife grew angry and lashed out at the other, or where addictive compulsions or a desperate need for approval led a youthful gang member to kill, or where a person felt so restricted in their lives that they embezzled or defrauded or manipulated someone for gain, in all these situations, there was someone perfectly placed to have prevented the violence, but who had failed to act. Now, the 10th insight was emerging, and we knew that the people in our lives were probably souls with whom we had had long relationships over many lifetimes, and who were now counting on our help. So, we are compelled to act, compelled to be courageous. None of us wants to have failure on our conscience or to have to bear a torturous life review in which we must watch the tragic consequences of our timidity. As the scenes rushed past, we saw this burgeoning awareness motivating activity toward other social problems as well. I could see an image of the world's rivers and oceans, and again I observed a new synthesis of the old and new, which, while admitting the often capricious behavior of government bureaucracy, also raised to a new level of priority the human desire to safeguard the environment, initiating a surge of private intervention. Similarly, we observed the environmental practices of governments themselves being exposed, especially regarding policies toward public lands. For years, it would be discovered, governmental agencies had sold mining and logging rights on some of the most sacred places on Earth at below market rates as political favors and paybacks. Majestic cathedral forests belonging to the public had been unbelievably pillaged and clear-cut in the name of proper forest management, as though planting rows of pine trees would replace the diversity of life and energies inherent in a hardwood forest that had matured for centuries. Yet it would be the emerging spiritual awareness that would finally force an end to such disgrace. we watched a new coalition forming, made up of old zoo hunters and nostalgic history buffs, and those who perceive the natural sites as sacred portals. This coalition would finally sound the alarm that would save the few remaining virgin forests in Europe and North America, and begin to protect on a larger scale the essential rainforests in the tropical regions of the world. It would be commonly understood that every remaining site of beauty must be saved for the benefit of the future. As we continued to watch, the scenes accelerated forward, and we could see individuals remembering their spiritual missions at increasingly younger ages. Here we could see the precise understanding that would soon embody the new spiritual worldview. Individuals would come of age and remember themselves as souls born from one dimension of existence into another. Although memory loss during the transition would be expected, recapturing pre-life memory would become an important early goal of education. As youths, our teachers would first guide us through the early experience of synchronicity, urge us to identify our intuitions to study certain subjects, to visit particular places, always looking for higher answers as to why we were pursuing these particular paths. As the full memory of the insights emerged, we would find ourselves involved with certain groups, working on particular projects, bringing in our full vision of what we had wanted to do. And finally, we would recover the underlying intention behind our lives. We would know that we came here to raise the vibratory level of this planet, to discover and protect the beauty and energy of its natural sites, and to ensure that all humans had access to these special locations so that we could continue to increase our energy, ultimately instituting the afterlife culture here in the physical. Such a worldview would especially shift the way we looked at other people. No longer would we see human beings merely in the racial dress or national origin of one particular lifetime. Instead, we would see others as brother or sister souls, engaged like us in a process of coming awake and of spiritualizing the planet. It would become known that the settling of certain souls into various geographical locations on the planet had occurred with great meaning. Each nation was, in fact, an enclave of specific spiritual information, shared and modeled by its citizens, information waiting to be learned and integrated. As I watched the future unfold, I could see that a world political unity, envisioned by so many, was finally being achieved, not by forcing all nations into subservience to one political body, but rather through a grassroots acknowledgement of our spiritual similarities, while treasuring our local autonomy and cultural differences. As with individuals interacting in a group, each member of the family of nations was being recognized for the cultural truth they represented to the world at large. Before us, we saw Earth's political struggles, so often violent, shifting into a war of words. As the tide of remembrance continued to sweep the planet, all humans began to understand that our destiny was to discuss and compare the perspective of our relative religions, and while honoring the best of their individual doctrines at the personal level, to ultimately see that each religion supplemented the others, and to integrate them into a synthesized global spirituality. We could see clearly that these dialogues would result in the rebuilding of a grand temple in Jerusalem, jointly occupied by all the major religions, Jewish, Christian, Islamic, Eastern, even the de facto religion of secular idealism, represented by those economic enclaves in China and Europe who thought primarily in terms of a pantheistic economic utopia. Here, ultimate spiritual perspective would be debated and discussed. And in this war of words and energy, at first, the Islamic and the Jewish perspectives would hold center stage. Then the Christian perspective would be compared and integrated along with the inner vision of the Eastern religions. We saw the awareness of humanity entering another level, with the collective human culture progressing from primarily the sharing of economic information to the synchronistic exchange of spiritual truths. As this occurred, certain individuals and groups would begin to reach levels approaching that of the afterlife dimension, and would disappear to the larger majority remaining on Earth. These select groups would walk intentionally into the other dimension, yet would learn to go back and forth, just as the ninth insight predicts, and the scriptural prophets saw. Yet after this rapture began, those left on Earth would understand what was occurring, and accept their role in remaining in the physical, knowing that they would soon follow. Now it was time for the secular idealists to proclaim their truths on the temple steps. At first, their energetic thrust into Jerusalem would come from Europe, with its primarily secular vision, with one strong leader proclaiming the spiritual importance of secular matters. This perspective would be met strongly by the determined otherworldly spiritualism of the Muslims and the Christians. But then this conflict of energy would be mediated and later synthesized into one by the inner spiritual emphasis of the Eastern perspective. By then, the last attempts of the controllers, who had once conspired to create a tyrannical society of chips and robots and forced compliance, would have been won over by the contagion of awakening. And this last synthesis would open everyone to the final infusion of the Holy Spirit. We saw clearly that through this Middle Eastern dialogue of energy integration, history had fulfilled the scriptural prophecies in a symbolic and verbal manner, avoiding the physical apocalypse expected by the literalists. Suddenly, our focus shifted to the afterlife dimension. And here we could see with great clarity that our intention all along was not merely to create a new earth, but a new heaven as well. We watched as the effect of the world vision remembrance not only transformed the physical dimension, but the afterlife as well. During the raptures on earth, the soul groups would also have been rapturing toward the physical dimension, completing the transfer of energy into the expanded physical dimension. Here, the stark reality of what was happening in the historical process became apparent. From the beginning of time, as our memory opened, energy and knowledge had systematically moved from the afterlife dimension into the physical. At first, the soul groups in the afterlife had borne full responsibility for maintaining the intention and envisioning the future, helping us to recall what we wanted to do, giving us energy. Then, as consciousness on Earth progressed, and the population increased, the balance of energy and responsibility had slowly shifted toward the physical dimension. Until, at this point in history, when enough energy had shifted and the world vision was being remembered, and more souls than ever before were living on the planet, the power and responsibility for believing and creating the intended future would be shifting from the afterlife to the souls on Earth, to the newly forming groups, to us. At this point, we would have to carry the intent. And that's why it fell to us to resolve the polarization and to help shift the particular individuals right here in this valley who were still caught in the fear and who felt justified in manipulating the economy for their own purposes, justified in seizing control of the future. At exactly the same time, all four of us glanced at each other in the darkness, the hologram still surrounding us. The soul group still merged in the background, glowing brightly. Abruptly, a silent vibration tingled my solar plexus. The experiment had been reactivated. "Look over there!" Curtis suddenly yelled. 50 yards away, barely distinguishable in the moonlight, was a narrow fissure, shaking the bushes and small trees, extending slowly in our direction. I looked at the others. "It's up to us now," Maya shouted. "We have enough of the vision now. We can stop them." Before we could act, the earth under us shook violently, and the fissure accelerated toward us. Simultaneously, several vehicles pulled to a stop in the underbrush, their lights shining through fuzzy silhouettes made by the trees and dust. Unafraid, I maintained my energy and focused again on the hologram. "The vision will stop them," Maya yelled again. "Don't let the vision go. Hold it." Embracing the image of the future before us, I again felt the group marshal energy towards Thaman, as if holding our intention like a giant wall against his intrusion, imaging his group being pushed back by the energy, fleeing in terror. I glanced at the crevice, still racing toward us, confident it would soon stop. It accelerated instead. Another tree fell, then another. As it sped into the group, I lost my concentration and rolled backward, choking on the dust. "It's still not working!" I heard Curtis yell. I felt like it was all happening again. "Up this way!" I shouted, struggling to see in the sudden darkness. As I ran, I could barely make out the dim outlines of the others. They were veering away from me, to the east. I climbed up the stony ridge that formed the left wall of the canyon and didn't stop until I was 100 yards away. Kneeling on the rocks, I looked out into the night. Nothing moved, but I could hear Feynman's men talking at the canyon entrance. Quietly, I made my way further up the slope, angling northwest, still watching carefully for any sign of the others. Finally, I found a way to climb down to the canyon floor again. Still, no movement anywhere. Then, as I began to walk north again, someone suddenly grabbed me from behind. "What?" I yelled. "Shh," the voice whispered. "Be quiet. It's David." I turned and looked at him in the moonlight, observing the long hair, the scarred face. "Where are the others?" he whispered. "We were separated," I replied. "Did you see what happened?" He moved his face closer. "Yes, I was watching from the hill." "Where do you think they'll go?" I thought for a moment. "They'll head toward the falls." He motioned for me to follow, and we started in that direction. After several minutes had passed, he glanced back as he walked and said, "When you were sitting together at the entrance back there, your energy pooled, then swelled far out into the valley. What were you doing?" In an attempt to explain, I summarized the whole story. Finding Will and entering into the other dimension, seeing Williams and running into Joel and Maya, and especially meeting Curtis and trying to bring in the world vision and defeat Feynman. "Curtis was back there with you at the mouth of the canyon?" David asked. "Yes, and Maya and Charlene, although I think there are supposed to be 7 of us." He gave me another quick glance, almost chuckling. All of the tense, pent-up anger he had displayed in town seemed to have completely disappeared. "So you found the ancestors, too, didn't you?" I hurried up to walk beside him. "You reached the other dimension?" "Yes. I saw my soul group, and I witnessed my birth vision. And just as you, I remembered what happened before, that we've all come back to bring in the world vision. And then, I don't know how, when I was watching all of you back there in the moonlight, it was as if I was with you, was part of your group. I saw the world vision around me." He had stopped in the shadow of a large tree which had blocked the moon, his face rigid and cast back. I turned to face him. "David, when the group of us were together back there and we brought in the world vision, why didn't it stop Feynman?" He moved forward into the light, and immediately I recognized him as the angry chief who had rebuked Maya. Then his rock-hard expression shifted, and he burst out laughing. "The key aspect of this vision is not the mere experience of it, although that's hard enough. It's how we project this vision of the future, how we hold it for the rest of humanity. That's what the 10th insight is really all about. You didn't hold the vision for Feynman and others in a way that would help them wake up." He looked at me a moment longer, then said, "Come on, we have to hurry." After we had traveled perhaps half a mile, a bird of some kind cried out toward our right, and David stopped abruptly. "What was that?" I asked. "That's a screech owl, signaling the others that we are here." I gave him a blank expression, remembering how strange the animals had been acting ever since I arrived in the valley. "Does anyone in that group know the animal signs?" he asked. "I don't know. Maybe Curtis?" "No, he's too scientific." I suddenly remembered that Maya had mentioned following the sounds of birds when she had found us in the cave. Perhaps Maya. He looked at me questioningly. The physician you mentioned, who uses visualization in her work?
Yes.
Good, that's perfect. Let's do what she does and pray.
What?
Let's visualize that she remembers the gift of the animals.
What is the gift of the animals?
A trace of anger flashed across his face, and he paused for a moment, closing his eyes, obviously trying to shake off the emotion. Haven't you understood that when a wild animal shows up in our lives, it is a coincidence of the highest order? I told him about the rabbit and the flock of crows and the hawk, which had shown up as I first entered the valley. He nodded expectantly. I knew something significant was happening, I said, but I didn't know exactly what to do except to follow some of them. Are you saying that all these animals had a message for me?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
How do I know what the message is?
It's easy.
You know, because of the particular kind of animal you are attracting at any one time. Each species that crosses our paths tells us something about our situation, what part of ourselves we must call upon to handle the circumstances we face.
Even after everything that's happened, I said, that's hard to believe. A biologist would say animals are primarily robots operating on dumb instinct.
Only because animals reflect our own levels of consciousness and expectation. If our level of vibration is low, the animals will merely be there with us, performing their usual ecological functions. When a skeptical biologist reduces animal behavior to mindless instinct, he sees the restriction that he himself has put upon the animal. But as our vibration shifts, the actions of the animals that come to us become ever more synchronistic, mysterious, and instructional.
I just stared.
Squinting, he said, "The hare that you saw was pointing out a direction for you both physically and emotionally. When I talked to you in town, you seemed depressed and fearful, as though you were losing faith in the insights. If you watch a wild rabbit for a long time, you can perceive that it models how to really face our fear, so that we can later move past it into creativity and abundance. A rabbit lives in close proximity to other animals which feed on it. But it handles the fear and stays there and outdances its attackers and is still very fertile and productive and upbeat. When a rabbit appears in our lives, it is a signal to find the same attitude within ourselves. This was the message to you. Its presence meant that you had the opportunity to remember the medicine of rabbit and to fully look at your own fear and move beyond it. And because it occurred during the beginning of your trip, it set the tone for your whole adventure. Hasn't your trip been both fearful and abundant?
I nodded.
He added, sometimes it means that the abundance can be of a romantic nature, too.
Have you met anyone?
I shrugged, remembering the new energy I had felt with Charlene.
Maybe in a way.
What about the crows I saw? And the hawk that I followed when I found Will. Crows are the holders of the laws of spirit. Spend time with crows, and they will do amazing things that always increase our perception of spiritual reality. Their message was to open up, to remember the spiritual laws that were presenting themselves to you in this valley. Seeing them should have prepared you for what was to come.
And the hawk?
Hawks are alert and observant, ever vigilant for the next bit of information, the next message. Their presence means that it is important at that time to increase our alertness. Often, they signal that a messenger is close.
He cocked his head.
You mean it was foretelling the presence of Will?
Yes.
So, the animals represent parts of ourselves we need to get in touch with.
Yes, yes. Aspects of ourselves that we developed when we were those animals during the course of evolution, but have lost.
I thought of the vision of evolution I had witnessed at the canyon entrance with the group.
You're speaking of the way life progressed forward, species by species?
We were there, David continued. Our consciousness moved through each animal as it represented the end point of life's development, and then leaped to the next. We experience the way each species views the world,
which is an important aspect of the complete spiritual consciousness. When a particular animal comes around, that means we're ready to integrate their consciousness into our waking awareness again. And I'll tell you something. There are some species that we aren't even close to catching up with. That's why it's so important to preserve every life form on this earth. We want them to endure not just because they are part of the balanced ecosphere, but because they represent aspects of ourselves that we're still trying to remember. He paused for a moment, looking out into the night. This is also true of the rich diversity of human thought, represented by the various cultures around the planet. None of us knows exactly where the end point of human evolution resides. Each culture around the world has a slightly different world view, a particular mode of awareness, and it takes the best of all cultures integrated together to make a more ideal whole. An expression of sadness crossed his face. It's too bad that 400 years had to pass before the real integration of the European and native cultures could begin. Think of what has happened. The Western mind lost touch with the mystery and reduced the magic of the deep woods to lumber and the mystery of wildlife to pretty animals. Urbanization has isolated the great majority of people, so we think a journey into nature is a stroll on the golf course. Do you realize how few of us have experienced the mysteries of the wilderness? Our national parks represent all that is left of the great cathedral forests and rich plains and high deserts that once characterized this continent. There are too many of us now for the wild areas that still exist. In many parks, there are waiting lists over a year long. And still, the politicians seem bent on selling off more and more of the public lands. Most of us are forced to draw from decks of animal cards to see what animal signs are coming into our lives, instead of being able to take quests into the truly wild areas of the world to experience the real thing. Suddenly the screech owl's cry erupted so close that the sound made me jump involuntarily. David was squinting impatiently. Can we pray now? Listen, I said, I don't know what you mean. Do you want to pray or visualize? He tried to calm his voice. Yes, I'm sorry. Impatience seems to be a residual emotion I have with you. He took a breath. The 10th insight. Learning to have faith in our intuitions, remembering our birth intention, holding the world vision, all of it is about understanding the essence of real prayer. Why does every religious tradition assume a form of prayer? If God is the one all-knowing, all-powerful God, then why would we have to beseech His help or impel Him to do something? Why wouldn't He just set up commandments and covenants and judge us accordingly, taking direct action when He wanted to, not us? Why would we have to ask for His special intervention? The answer is that when we pray in the correct fashion, we are not asking God to do something. God is inspiring us to act in His place, to enact His will on earth. We are the emissaries of the divine on this planet. True prayer is the method, the visualization that God expects us to use in discerning His will and implementing it in the physical dimension. His kingdom come, His will be done on earth as it is in heaven. In this sense, every thought, every expectation, all of what we visualize happening in the future is a prayer, intends to create that very future. But no thought or desire or fear is as strong as a vision that is in alignment with the divine. That's why bringing in the world vision and holding it is important, so we will know what to pray for, what future to visualize. I understand, I said. How do we help Maya become aware of the owl? What did she say to do when she talked to you about psychic healing? She said we should visualize the patient, remembering what they intended to do with their lives, but still hadn't done. She said that real healing springs from a renewed sense of what one wants to do once health is regained. When they remember, then we can join them in holding this more specific plan. Let's do the same now,
David said. Hopefully her original intention was to follow the sound of this bird. David closed his eyes and I followed his lead, trying to visualize an image of Maya awakening to what she was supposed to do. After a few minutes, I opened my eyes and David was staring at me. The owl screamed again, right above our heads. Let's go, he said. 20 minutes later, we were standing on the hill above the falls. The owl had followed, calling out periodically, and it stationed itself 50 feet to our right. In front of us, the pool glistened in the moonlight, muted only by wisps of fog that drifted along its surface. We waited for 10 or 15 minutes without speaking. Look, there, David said, pointing. Among the rocks to the right of the pool, I could make out several figures. Simultaneously, one of them looked up and saw us. It was Charlene. I waved, and she recognized me. Then David and I made our way down the rocky slope to where they were standing. Curtis was ecstatic at seeing David, grabbing his arm. We'll stop these people now. For a moment, they looked at each other in silence. Then Curtis introduced Maya and Charlene. I met eyes with Maya. Did you have any trouble finding your way here? At first, we were confused and lost in the darkness, but then I heard an owl, and I knew. The presence of an owl, David said, means that we have the opportunity to see through any possible deception by others, and if we avoid the tendency to harm or lash out, we can, like the owl, cut through the darkness to hold a higher truth. Maya was watching David closely. You look familiar, Maya said. Who are you? He looked at her questioningly. You were told my name. It's David. She grabbed his hand gently. No, I mean, who are you to me? To us? I was there, he said, during the wars. But I was so full of hatred for the whites that I didn't support you. I didn't even listen to you. We're doing it differently now, I said. David glared at me reflexively, then caught himself and softened, as he had before. Back in that war, I had even less respect for you than the others. You wouldn't take a stand. You ran away. It was fear, I replied. I know. For several more minutes, everyone talked with David about the emotions we were feeling, discussing everything we could remember about the tragedy of the war on the Native Americans. David went on to explain that his soul group was made up of mediators, and that he had come this time to work through his anger at the European mentality, and then to work for the spiritual recognition of all indigenous cultures and the inclusion of all people. Charlene glanced at me, then turned to David. You're the fifth member of this group, aren't you? Before he could answer, we felt a vibration racing through the ground under our feet. It sent irregular ripples across the surface of the pool. Accompanying the tremor was another eerie, melodious whine that filled the forest. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw flashlights moving on the hill 50 feet above us.
They're here, Curtis whispered.
I turned to see Feynman at the edge of an overhang directly above our heads. He was adjusting a small dish antenna on what looked like a portable computer.
They're going to focus on us and try to fine-tune the generator that way, Curtis said. We've got to get out of here.
Maya reached over and touched his arm. No, please, Curtis. Maybe it will work this time. David moved closer to Curtis, then said slowly, It can work. Curtis stared at him for a moment, then finally nodded his agreement, and we quickly began to raise our energy. As in the two previous attempts, I began to see higher self-expressions on every face, and then our soul groups appeared and quickly merged into a circle around us, including for the first time the members of David's group. As the memory of the world vision returned, we were again pulled into the overall intent to transfer energy and knowledge and awareness into the physical dimension. Also, as before, we saw the fearful polarization occurring in our time, and the panoramic vision of the positive future that was succeeded once the special groups formed and learned how to intercede, how to hold the vision. Suddenly, another tremor shook the ground violently. Stay with the vision, Maya shouted. Hold the image of how the future can be. I heard a fissure tear through the ground to my right, but I kept my concentration. In my mind, I again saw the world vision as a force of energy that was emanating outward from our group in all directions, and pushing Feynman back, away from us, defeating the energy of his fear vision. To my left, a huge tree ripped from its roots and crashed to the ground. "It's still not working!" Curtis shouted, jumping to his feet. "No, wait!" David said. He had been deep in thought, and now he reached out and grabbed Curtis, pulling him down beside him. "Don't you see what's wrong? We're treating Feynman and the others as if they are enemies, trying to push them back. Doing that actually strengthens them, because they have something to fight against. Rather than fighting them with the vision, we have to include Feynman and the operatives in what we're visualizing. In reality, there are no enemies. We're all souls in growth, waking up. We have to project the world vision toward them as though they are just like us." I suddenly recalled seeing Feynman's birth vision. Now it all made perfect sense. The view of hell, understanding the obsessive trance state that humans use to ward off fear, seeing the ring of souls as they try to intervene, and then observing Feynman's original intention. "He's one of us," I shouted. "I know what he intended to do." In actuality, he came to break through his need for power. He wanted to prevent the destruction that could be caused by the generators and the other new technology. He saw himself meeting with us in the darkness. He's the sixth member of this group. Maya leaned forward. "This works just like in the process of healing. We have to image him remembering what he is really here to do." She glanced at me. "That helps break the fear block, the trance, at every level." As we began to concentrate on including Feynman and his men, our energy immediately leaped forward. The night became illuminated, and we could clearly see Feynman and two men on the hill. The soul group seemed to move more closely into focus, appearing more human-like, while at the same time we became more luminescent, like them. From the left, more soul groups seemed to be joining. "It's Feynman's soul group," Charlene said, "and the soul groups of the two men with him." As the energy increased, the massive hologram of the world vision again encircled us. "Focus on Feynman and the others the way we focused on each other," Maya shouted, "visualizing that they remember." Feynman was still working furiously at his computer, the other two men looking on. The hologram encircled them as well, especially the image of each person awakening at this historical moment to their true purpose. As we watched, the forest was cast in a perceptible field of swirling amber energy which seemed to pass through Feynman and his associates. Simultaneously, I saw the same wisps of white light that had protected Curtis and Maya and I hovering over the men. After which, the white streaks of light grew in size and began to emanate outward in all directions, disappearing finally into the distance. After a few minutes, the ground tremors and strange sounds completely stopped. A breeze blew the last of the dust toward the south. One of the men stopped watching Feynman and eased away from us into the trees. For several seconds, Feynman continued to work on his keyboard, then finally gave up in frustration. He looked down at us and picked up the computer, cradling it gently with his left arm. With the other hand, he pulled a handgun and began to walk our way. The other man, armed with an automatic weapon, followed. "Don't let go of the image," Maya cautioned. When they were 20 feet away, Feynman set the computer down and punched at the keyboard again, keeping the pistol ready. Several large rocks, loosened earlier, broke free and crashed into the pool. "You didn't come here to do this," Charlene said softly. The rest of us focused on his face. The operative, keeping his weapon aimed at us, walked closer to Feynman and said, "We can't do anything else here. Let's go." Feynman waved him off and then began to type angrily again. "Nothing is working," Feynman yelled at us. "What are you doing?" He looked at the operative. "Shoot them," he screamed. "Shoot them." For an instant, the man looked at us coldly. Then, shaking his head,
He backed away and disappeared into the rocks. You were born to prevent this destruction from happening, I said. He dropped the gun to his side and stared at me. For an instant, his face lightened, appearing exactly as I had seen it during his birth vision. I could tell that he was remembering something. Seconds later, a look of fright swept across his face, turning quickly into anger. He grimaced and held his stomach, then turned and retched slightly onto the rocks beside him. Wiping his mouth, he raised the gun again.
I don't know what you're trying to do to me, but it won't work.
He took several steps forward, then seemed to lose energy. The gun fell to the ground.
It doesn't matter, you know. There are other forests. You people can't be at all of them. I'm going to make this generator work. Do you understand?
You're not taking this away from me.
He stumbled backward a few feet, then turned and ran into the darkness. When we reached the hill above the bunker, a great wave of relief swept through the group. After Feynman had left, we had cautiously made our way back to the site of the experiment, not knowing what we would find. Now, as we looked, the bunker area was aglow with dozens of truck lights. Most of the vehicles bore the insignia of the Forest Service, although the FBI was represented along with the local sheriff's office. I crawled forward several more feet on the crest of the hill and looked closely to see if anyone was being interrogated or held in any of the cars. They all looked empty. The door of the bunker was open, and officers seemed to be going in and out, as if investigating a crime scene.
They've all left, Curtis said, leaning forward on his knees and gazing past the trunk of a large tree.
We stopped them.
Maya turned and sat down.
Well, at least we stopped them here. They won't try the experiment again in this valley.
But Feynman was right, David said, looking at the rest of us.
They can go to some other place and no one will know.
He stood up.
I've got to go in there. I'll tell them the whole story.
Are you crazy? Curtis said, walking up to him. What if the government is part of this?
The government is just people, David replied. Not all of them are involved.
Curtis stepped up closer.
There has to be another way. I'm not letting you go in there.
There will be someone in one of those agencies who will listen to us, David said. I'm sure of it.
Curtis was silent. Charlene was leaning on a rock several feet away and said, He's right. Someone would be in just the right position to help. Curtis shook his head, grappling with his thoughts.
That might be true, but you'll need someone with you who can accurately describe the technology.
That means you'll have to go too, David said.
Curtis managed to return a smile.
Okay, I'll go with you, but only because we have an ace in the hole.
What?
David asked.
A guy that we left tied up back in the cave.
David put a hand on his shoulder.
Come on, you can tell me about it on the way. Let's see what happens.
After anxious goodbyes to the rest of us, they moved away to the right to approach the bunker site from another direction. Suddenly, Maya whispered loudly for them to wait.
I'm going too, she said. I'm a physician. People know me in the area. You might need a third witness.
The three of them looked at Charlene and me, obviously wondering if we might join them as well.
Not me, Charlene said. I think I'm needed elsewhere.
I also declined and asked them not to mention us. They agreed and then walked away toward the lights. Left alone, Charlene and I met eyes. I recalled the deep feeling I had experienced toward her in the other dimension. She was taking a step toward me, about to speak, when both of us detected a flashlight 50 yards to our right. Carefully, we moved deeper into the trees. The light changed position and headed right toward us. We kept still and low to the ground. As the light approached, I began to hear a lone voice, someone apparently talking to himself. I knew this person. It was Joel. I caught Charlene's eye.
I know who it is, I whispered. I think we should talk to him.
She nodded. When he was 20 feet away, I called out his name. He stopped and shined his light toward us. Recognizing me immediately, he walked over and crouched down where we were.
What are you doing out here? I asked.
Well, there's not much left back there, he replied, pointing toward the bunker. The underground laboratory has been completely cleaned out. I thought I would try to go to the falls, but when I got out there in the dark, I changed my mind. I thought you were leaving the area, I said. You were so skeptical. I know. I was going to leave, but I had a dream that disturbed me. I thought I'd better stay and try to help. The Forest Service people thought I was crazy, but then I ran into a deputy from the county sheriff's office. Someone had sent him a message, so we came out here together. That's when we found this underground laboratory. Charlene and I looked at each other. Then I briefly told Joel about the confrontation with Feynman and the eventual outcome. They were creating that much damage, Joel asked. Was anyone hurt? I don't think so, I replied. We were lucky. And how long ago did your friends go down there?
Just a few minutes ago.
He looked at both of us.
You're not going in yourselves?
I shook my head. I thought it would be better if we watched how the authorities handle all this, without their knowing. Charlene's expression confirmed that she felt the same way.
Good thinking, Joel said, looking back toward the bunker site.
I think I'd better go back down there, though, just so they'll know the press is aware of those three witnesses. How can I get in touch with you?
We'll call you, Charlene said.
He handed me a card, nodded to Charlene, and headed toward the bunker. Charlene caught my eye.
He was the seventh person in the group, wasn't he?
I touched her shoulder.
Yeah, I think so.
We were silent with our thoughts for a moment. Then Charlene said,
Come on, let's try to get back to town.
We walked for almost an hour, when suddenly we heard the sound of songbirds, dozens of them, somewhere to our right. Dawn was just breaking, and a cool mist rose from the forest floor.
Now what? Charlene asked.
Look over there, I said. Through a break in the trees to the north was a huge old poplar, perhaps 8 feet in diameter. In the half-light of daybreak, the area around the tree appeared brighter somehow, as if the sun, still below the horizon, had been in position to burst through to radiate downward on that one spot. I experienced the sense of warmth that had grown so familiar.
What is it? Charlene asked.
It's Will, I said. Let's go over there. When we were within 10 feet, Will peeked around the tree, smiling broadly. He had changed. His luminosity was the same, but he was now more clearly in focus. He hugged us both.
Were you able to see what happened? I asked.
Yes, he said. I was there with the soul groups. I saw everything.
You're in sharper focus. What did you do?
It wasn't what I did, he replied. It was what you and the group did, especially Charlene.
What do you mean?
Charlene asked. When the five of you increased your energy and consciously remembered most of the world vision, you lifted this whole valley into a higher vibratory pattern. It rose closer to the vibratory level of the afterlife, which means that I now appear clearer to you, as you appear clearer to me. Even the soul groups will become more readily visible in this valley now. I looked hard at Will. Everything we've seen in this valley, everything that has happened, it's all the tenth insight, isn't it? He nodded. These same experiences are occurring to people all over the planet. After we grasp the first 9 insights, each of us is left at the same place, trying to live this reality day to day in the face of what seems to be a growing pessimism and divisiveness all around us. But at the same time, we are continuing to gain a greater perspective and clarity about our spiritual situation, about who we really are. We know we are awakening to a much larger plan for planet Earth. The tenth is about maintaining our optimism and staying awake. First, we're learning to better identify and believe in our own intuitions, knowing that these mental images are fleeting recollections of our original intention, of how we wanted our lives to evolve. When we have faith in these images and follow their guidance, the events that take place feel coincidental, destined, because we remember we wanted them to happen. We wanted to follow a certain path in life, so that we could finally remember the truth that our life experiences are preparing us to tell, and bring this knowledge
into the world. We are now seeing our lives from the higher perspective of the afterlife. We know that our individual adventures are occurring within the context of the long history of human awakening. With this memory, our lives are grounded, put into context. We can see the long process through which we have been spiritualizing the physical dimension, and what we have left to do. Will paused momentarily and moved closer to us. Now we will see if enough groups like this one come together and remember, if enough people around the world grasp the tenth. As we have seen, it is now our responsibility to keep the intention, to ensure the future. The polarization of fear is still rising, and if we are to resolve it and move on, each of us must participate personally. We must watch our thoughts and expectations very carefully and catch ourselves every time we treat another human being as an enemy. We can defend ourselves and restrain certain people, but if we dehumanize them, we add to the fear. We are all souls in growth. We all have an original intention that is positive, and we can all remember. Our responsibility is to hold that idea for everyone we meet. That's the true interpersonal ethic. That's how we uplift. That's the contagion of the new awareness that's encircling the planet. We either fear that human culture is falling apart, or we can hold the vision that we are awakening. Either way, our expectation is a prayer that goes out as a force that tends to bring about the end we envision. Each of us must consciously choose between these two futures. In the background, against the far ridge toward the south, I caught sight again of the streaks of white light. With all that was happening, I said, I never asked you about those movements of white light. Do you know what they are? Will smiled and reached out and gently touched both of our shoulders. They're the angels, he said. They respond to our faith and vision and make miracles. They seem to be a mystery even to those in the afterlife. At that moment, I was seized by a mental image of a community somewhere in a valley much like this one. Charlene was there, and others, including many children. I think we're supposed to understand the angels next, Will continued, gazing out toward the north, as if seeing an image of his own. Yes, I'm sure of it. Are you two coming? I gazed at Charlene, whose look confirmed that she had seen the same vision as I. I don't think so, she said. Not right now, I added. Without speaking, Will pulled us into a brief embrace, then turned and walked away. For an instant, I felt the urge to call out to him, but I let him go. Sometime, someplace, I knew we would see him again.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of The Tenth Insight, written and with an introduction by James Redfield, produced and directed by Naya Thomas, text abridged by John Whitman, production coordinator Daniel Metcalf, original music by Ken Heller, tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Martin Royer.